Hey there, this is Steve from Mudhoney, coming down to Australia pretty soon. We're going to be touring on our new record, Plastic Eternity, and you are here listening to The Vinyl Guide.
This episode is brought to you by Groove Washer, the best record cleaners and protective sleeves for your vinyl collection. Ask for the Groove Washer from your local shop or go to groovewasher.com. Discount code VinylGuide10. And now, on with the show.
Well, hey everyone, it's Nate. Welcome to episode 384 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. And guess what, peoples? Today we've got a record collecting music legend here on the show, Mr. Steve Turner of Mudhoney, who today regales us with many a tale of record hunting, collecting, the rarities of his collection and career, the early Sub Pop releases, working at Cascade Record Pressing, managing the Super Electro record label, buying up punk singles for a laughably low amount of money, our love for the Melvins, and lots more. And I've got two things to tell you. Number one, Mudhoney has a brand new album, Plastic Eternity, coming out April 7th. You can dial up a track or two on your streaming services now and get ready for the full album on April 7th. There's limited vinyl runs available at mudhoney.bandcamp.com. And for you Australian listeners, Mudhoney is coming back down under starting mid-April through early May. See these legends in your town. Details and tickets available at mudhoney.org. And if you like this conversation with Steve, there are hundreds of other interviews available for free anytime from the Vinyl Guide podcast, including Jason Bonham, son of Led Zeppelin drummer John Bonham, sharing lots of Led Zeppelin stories. That's episode 383 of the Vinyl Guide. Chris Shiflett of Foo Fighters, talking records and more, episode 382. Jerry A. Lang of Poison Idea, episode 372. Mr. Keith Morris of Off, Circle Jerks, and Black Flag, episode 352. Thomas Andrew Doyle of Tad, episode 345. Jack Endino, producer, mixer, noisemonger of lots of Sub Pop classics, episode 334. Mike Watt of Minutemen, the Saint of San Pedro, he joins us, episode 223. Matt Cameron of Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, and more, episode 219, and literally hundreds more. Subscribe to The Vinyl Guide for free in your podcast app of choice. Scroll, download, listen, and enjoy. Alrighty, peoples, grab your beers and away we go. Here's The Vinyl Guide interview with Steve Turner of Mudhoney. Ladies and gentlemen, this week on The Vinyl Guide, we have with us a musician, songwriter, former label owner, record nerd, and now author, Mr. Steve Turner, who you likely know most from Mudhoney, but all sorts of other projects. So, Steve, thank you very much for coming on the show today, mate.
Sure thing.
So, I understand there's a lot of stuff going on, so let me try to kind of organize this a little bit. New Mudhoney LP, Plastic Eternity. Out yep. April 7th at Sub Pop. There's a limited loser edition, which people can get at mudhoney.bandcamp.com or, of course, at subpop.com. Then the crew is off to Australia. They're coming here to all the usual haunts and many more. Coolangatta, Byron Bay, Brisbane, Sydney, Bedford, Wollongong, Canberra through Melbourne, a few other cities, Adelaide, Perth, Margaret River, and also a book coming out. So, so lots of stuff going on. Where do you find time to fit it all in, Steve?
Well, remember we were kind of on lockdown for a couple of years, right?
So I didn't hear about that. No, tell me more. Fair enough. So all these things have been brewing for a while. Now, understanding that everyone has different lives to lead and whatnot, let's start with the album first. What makes it time for a new Mudhoney album?
We're kind of on a 5-year plan, it seems like. Every 5 years we managed to get another record together. We didn't see each other for a year and a half during pandemic, and once we had a couple shots in us, we started rehearsing again. And then we kind of had a time crunch because we had some things we wanted to do once we thought we could actually do them, like go on tour and try to get a record out. But you know, we were a little bit behind schedule as far as writing songs went, so this is one of the first times that we've actually gone to the studio with just bare bone ideas of songs and invented them in the studio with plenty of help from our producer engineer Johnny Sangster.
Okay, so if you had a lot of time to be able to create the songs, but for some reason
we weren't getting together. Yeah, but we weren't getting together and rehearsing. And that's we don't like send demos back and forth to each other. Really, we have to be in the room together to figure things out. And so, you know, we were behind, but we all had a backlog of song ideas, at least, you know, but then it was just, okay, quick, put them together.
Now, when you're in your separate corners, you're writing, you're developing these ideas, in your mind, do you say, okay, this is for solo project, or this is for Mud Honey, or is it all just kind of one big messy pile that gets sorted when it needs to?
I haven't really been doing solo stuff for years. So I kind of consider it all sort of for Mud Honey at this point. You know, I have little other tiny oddball projects, but I'm usually just helping other people develop their ideas and on those kind of things, like Sunday State and Phantom Ships and things like that that I've done in Portland. So yeah, it's kind of more Mud Honey. You know, I mean, I was fairly busy raising kids and stuff for a while there, but there wasn't a whole lot of time of just sitting around playing the guitar at home.
I know the feeling. There's like this 10-year period from when you have kids, when they're born to when they're old enough to kind of manage themselves a little bit, where I don't know any movies that came out except Pixar ones.
Yeah, exactly.
And I missed all sorts of tours in these 10 years.
So. Yep.
What's the meaning of the new album title, Plastic Eternity?
There's a song on the record called Plasticity. Mm-hmm. With Mark just bitching about plastic things, essentially. And that was just one of the lines in it, I guess, that kind of stood out to us. And it sounded like a good title.
Okay. All right. And, you know, Mud Honey, it's always seemed to me like a band that, there's a few bands that have had a similar trajectory, I guess, and I'm thinking like maybe Melvins or Bad Religion. Put out a few albums on a major label, then went back to a prior smaller label and are very much artistically satisfied with that. Does the band now have control or ownership of all the Mud Honey material?
You know, Warner Brothers and Sub Pop are kind of partnered up with Sub Pop, right? Warner Brothers owns a non-controlling percent of Sub Pop. So they work well together. The rights haven't come back to us 100% or anything like that for the Warner years, but, you know, they do well by it. You know, there's a box set on CD that came out a couple years ago, and that's, being turned into a slightly different vinyl box set, soon. You know, Warner's is, they're cool with, you know, doing whatever with it. I mean, it's not that big of a deal to them, I think, because it's not worth a whole lot of money anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we've seen the reissues of things like Piece of Cake on Music on Vinyl, some of those reissues. Does the band have anything to do with those?
We, on this box set that's coming out, we found them some unreleased demos and things like that to include in it and stuff. God, I wish I could remember the name of the label that's putting out the vinyl box set. I should know that, but I don't. But that's we've helped them as much as we can, you know, and line them up with Ed Fotheringham to do the artwork for the box set and all that kind of stuff. So it'll be a proper Mud Honey box set on vinyl of the Warner Brothers years.
Okay. Is that, and that's coming in 2023?
It's coming. I haven't heard an actual release date yet. You know, it's a 4-album box set or something like that.
Okay. Just the reprise years then, focusing on that. Okay.
Maybe five. Might be 5. Album. Wow. But yeah, there's some unreleased stuff and goodies, and it'll be cool.
Okay. That's fantastic. Yeah. Do they go in and do any remixes at the multi-tracks?
No remixes that I know of. I don't know if they were handing it off to who's mastering it and that kind of stuff, or if Jack and Dino had his hand in it or not. Probably not. I'm guessing. I mean, Jack worked with all the Sub Pop reissues and got them updated a bit, you know, especially not that I'm on it, but the Green River reissues that Sub Pop did of Rehab Doll is so much better than the original Rehab Doll, thanks to Jack.
Yeah. He's also done the Soundgarden one recently.
Yeah.
Okay.
I guess picked up the What's that? I didn't even know it had been reissued. Hang on, let me grab it. the Ultra Mega OK
yes.
double album reissue. That had escaped me. I didn't know that it happened. So I was pretty stoked on grabbing that.
Yeah. No, it sounds, I mean, night and day. I mean, I love the original album, but yeah, it's good to be revisited, especially with Jack's
yeah,
ears.
Yeah, totally.
Now,
that's really good. That.
Now, Mudhoney has access to all the tapes, all the multi-tracks. Is there anything missing from the Mudhoney archive?
I don't think so. Sub Pop got pretty organized with the archives years back, and they're all kept in some secret underground lair somewhere, like in Arizona.
Okay, as long as it wasn't that that warehouse that burned 10 years ago or whatever. So
no,
all the stuff does. Yeah, exist.
They've done a pretty good job of archiving everything, and the Warner stuff, I don't even know where that stuff is.
Okay, assuming it's safe somewhere.
Yeah, it's safe somewhere.
Okay, from what I understand, you are quite the record collector. Or at least were. You still collect records?
I still am.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Can you describe your collection?
Well, it's gone through lots of phases. When I started buying records, I was buying, you know, punk singles and things like that. And I also started buying the Pebbles compilations and 60s garage mm-hmm. stuff. And it dawned on me that all of these crappy little singles that were coming out in the late 70s, early 80s were going to be just as rare as all those 60s garage nuggets. So I started buying anything that was self-released or an independent label that looked interesting. So I had, you know, thousands and thousands of obscure punk, post-punk, dark wave, you know, new wave, oddball stuff, you name it. And when my son Milo was born, 18 and a half years ago now, I started dealing records online because I was working a you know, regular job as we, you know, most of us do. And I wanted to stay home for the first couple of years of his life. So I started kind of selling a lot of my collection of punk obscurities. And that kind of altered my whole frame of mind. I was no longer a collector. I was a dealer. And it kind of freed me in certain ways. I wasn't having dreams of, you know, searching for records and things like that anymore. And, you know, I still love the hunt, you know, that was always the thing for me, you know, and discovering things, but I'm good with having reissues. So all the weird punk records that I love, anytime one of them is reissued, I sell the original.
Right.
I'll buy the, I'll buy the reissue, you know, it might have extra songs on it even, who knows? So I'm not like a purist as far as a collector goes anymore. You know, at times I regret it and I wish, man, if I'd had like all the money in the world, I wouldn't have ever sold any of these records, but I don't know if I'd be any happier or not. You know, I still like going into like record stores that other people think are no good and just digging through the boxes on the ground, you know, and I still find really weird things that way. So, but yeah, I've been buying more records lately. I go through weird jags, and this is a weird one that Jeff Ament from Pearl Jam, you know, my old pal, of course, also mentioned recently. We've been buying Wyndham Hill records, the new age, you know, mostly instrumental guitar or piano stuff. I mean, that's, you know, I think they branch out a little bit from there, but and I think it goes back to in the early 80s, we both worked together at a coffee shop deli called Raison d'Etre in Seattle, and they played it all the time in there. And even back then in 1984, I was like, some of this stuff sounds really good, and it's dirt cheap still, so you know, you don't have to spend more than $3 on any old Wyndham Hill record from the late 70s or early 80s, and it's really incredibly well recorded acoustic folk, kind of sub John Fahey, not as radical as that, but kind of the same kind of deal, you know. And so I've been buying a bunch of those, as has he.
So that's the next wave. All right.
Yeah. Well, okay. The psychedelic collectors ran out of records to buy, so they started buying all those Christian folk records maybe 15 years ago. And that I thought that was, I was like, I think they've run out of records to find. So they're actually buying these mostly really awful Christian records where the people have long hair, like the Jesus freaks of the time, you know. And some of it's okay, some of it's good, some of it's way overvalued. So I could find that in thrift stores and, you know, flip those real easy for a while. And then I think they realized most of them sucked. So
it dried up. Or it could be the hippies are getting older and older and then trying to find Jesus for a gracious exit out of here.
Possibly. Yeah.
So what you're saying is punks turn to Wyndham Hill now.
Yes.
All right. I think everyone's surprised by that. So, all right, format wise, it sounds like 7-inch is kind of your thing. Are you more 7-inch than 12-inch?
Yeah. I mean, for, you know, I DJ on occasion and I only DJ with 7-inch records. Mm. Always have, except if it was a really long shift, I'd bring one compilation record I could put on and go.
Yeah.
Have a pizza or something, get a beer, whatever. But the 7-inch was what punk rock and hardcore was all about. They were cheap and easy to do and fairly quickly done back then. And you find your 2 or 3 or 8 best songs to put on a 7-inch, depending on the speed of your punk rock. And that was what was always fascinating to me.
Yeah. If a band can't get together and do a single, then they really need to rethink their strategy.
Completely. Yeah. That's why I remind the guys in Mudhoney sometimes when we start slowing down on the process of songwriting, I'm like, man, why don't we just pretend we're a brand new band and we need to get like 10 songs together to play a show. Hmm. And we're going to do it fast. But, you know, sometimes things take longer as you get older, I think. Plus, you know, we don't want to totally just repeat ourselves over and over, but I don't think spending more time on writing music makes it necessarily better.
No, it could be actually quite the opposite if over chew the gum.
Yeah, totally.
So
especially in the genres that I like playing, like garage rock and punk rock. I mean, you know, those were teenagers just putting some slop together. Yeah, I like that.
So I'm starting to see a few bands kind of slow down a bit on the long play release and to do more mm-hmm. singles, because now distribution is such that you can actually get a single out there relatively quick and physical form media aside, right? I mean, you could put singles on the internet within hours of doing them. Any sort of discussion within the band of, you know, right now it's still album, you know, build up 10, 12 songs and put out an album. Any talk in the band about maybe reducing that to 3 or 4, put out a single and divide that up a bit?
Well, we have a single coming out in Australia actually for this tour.
Ooh.
No, for us, it's like, you know, Mark likes doing a full project. I think he kind of can wrap his head around that more easily. We usually have more songs than we need for the record. For our last record, we ended up putting out an EP of the extra tracks after the fact, but a couple of them had come out on singles and stuff. I think we're going to do the same on this one. We have a few extra tracks again. So I think next year we'll have an EP come out of it all. But for this Australian tour, we do have a 7-inch of 2 non-LP tracks coming out on Tim Records from Brisbane.
Good. Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay. So we go to the Australian shows. I'm in Sydney, by the way. I know my accent betrays me. When we go to see you in Australia, there will be vinyl on the merch table.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
And a new record, too.
Yeah. Okay. And yeah, sure. And you seem to really come from a collector standpoint. So you know, let's only do 200 of these. Let's only do 500 of these. Are you involved in the sort of pressing and the conversations around number of records, color of records, that sort of thing?
A little bit. I think Tim is doing 400 copies of this tour single. You know, I worked at Cascade Record Pressing for 2.5 years, a pressing plant here near Portland. Mm-hmm. So I've seen it from the other side too.
So I guess my question, because I've always thought about, it'd be wild to work at a record pressing plant, but I would imagine it probably puts you off of records a little bit as well. Like, what was it? Did it help your attitude towards records, or did it kind of reduce the shine a bit?
It didn't really change it. It's it's factory work. You know, it's just it's a job. You know, you're depending on the day of the week, I would be in quality control, which meant I'd be listening to the same record over and over and over as they were coming off the press to make sure that things were still working out okay. Mm. And that was torture at times because some of the records were just terrible to me. I'd be in this little room by myself listening to this horrible music all day long, or I'd be, you know, shrink wrapping them or, you know, other mind numbing chores, you know, or lifting really heavy boxes of records. They were involved in pressing all these Pearl Jam live box sets.
Mm.
And those were killing us sometimes because most of us that were working there were not spring chickens. And
yeah.
Those the boxes of the box sets and getting them ready for shipping was just absolute torture on our backs, you know. And so I'd occasionally text Stone or Jeff going like, fuck you guys.
Yeah, you need to cut down your set length here.
Yeah, come on, man.
So Cascade, what was the specialty of Cascade?
Their specialty is low batch colored vinyl, actually, for independent bands. That seems to be their main thing. They have a 7-inch machine now that finally got up and running. And so they're doing a little bit more of that now. But yeah, they did a lot of, you know, smaller batch records. And I mean, they have big clients too. The owner, Mark, runs TKO Records, which is a punk label.
Yep.
He does a lot of, like, he does all the Poison Idea reissues and stuff like that. And, you know, there's definitely a lot of punk rock coming through there. Fat Records does a lot of work with them. Sub Pop does some, but not that much. You know, Sub Pop goes through RTI mainly down in LA. And RTI is kind of the big brother to Cascade. They really help and advised Cascade on what they were doing when they were first starting.
Okay. How many presses does Cascade
have? It's fairly thinly. I think they added a couple since I left there. I think they had like 8.
Mm-hmm.
And then like 1 7-inch machine that does 2 singles at a time in each rotation.
Right.
But yeah, so it's not a huge place or anything, but the whole industry seems fairly supportive and friendly with each other. Like all the different pressing plants seem to know each other and that sort of thing.
Is it fair to say you are the biggest record nerd in Mudhoney?
I think Dan's taken over my mantle. Yeah, Dan is just obsessed with buying records. Especially when we were in Europe a few months back, he bought so many records, like singles. He's a singles guy too, but he's more of a 60s. So he was getting different countries' pressings of stuff that he likes, you know, I guess soul, you know, 60s rock and roll of different types. But yeah, he was going nuts over there. So I think he and he's never sold any records either. So I'm going to say he probably has a lot more than I do.
So when you're on tour, you do a sound check and then you guys just kind of take off and try to find the local record shops before the show. Is that the routine?
That's happened most of the tours for me. Different tours, you know, the different financial obligations, like maybe I haven't done it as much, but yeah, what I used to do before the internet, I'd go to the phone booth, look in the phone book and tear out the page of record stores. When I got to a city. So then I go, okay, where am I going?
And I would imagine you'd be coming home with a lot more luggage than you left with.
Yes, quite often. Yeah. I mean, first couple of times I went to the UK, it was insane because all punk singles and just weirdo stuff from the late 70s, early 80s, in different cities, it'd be like 1 pound, maybe 2 pounds for just about anything. And so, you know, me and Dan, we all bought the every Buzzcocks single, every Strangler single, you know, that kind of thing. All the Dickie singles, you know, I guess whatever came out in the UK that were still cheap, but were hard to find in America. And then just started buying all the oddball stuff, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it was just so cheap. So, yeah, I'd come home with like 100 singles from a 2-week tour of the UK.
What are some of the records, maybe 2 or 3 that you remember top of your head that was like, oh, my God, this $1,000 record I bought for £1 somewhere.
We'll be back after these messages.
Hey everyone, I'm here to talk to you about Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Ever find a record in a used bin where the vinyl is gorgeous, but the sleeve has this ugly split and is even falling completely apart? Well, that's okay. Grab it anyway, because with Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips, you can fix that right up. Seems Easy record repair strips repair seam splits from the inside, so it doesn't affect the appearance of a record sleeve, but it does make it functional again. With Seems Easy, records can now slide in and out like new. Turn a $5 record into a $25 functioning collectible. Just ask your local record shop for Seems Easy strips, and if they're not in stock, go to seamseasy.com. That's Seems Easy with two Z's. Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Seems easy because it is. Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE. 10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits. What are some of the records, maybe two or three that you remember top of your head that was like, oh my God, this $1,000 record I bought for £1 somewhere?
Well, there's a few of those. I've sold records for $2,000. The punk singles, some of the pricing on those is absolutely insane now. People are willing to pay $5,000 for a 7-inch. Yeah. And I always joke, it must be like a German dentist or something buying all these $5,000 records.
It's tech bros, I think.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know what it is now, because I've sold most of those kind of records out of my collection at this point. But the first really expensive record I sold was a combo called Jackie Shark and the Beach Butchers. Second generation rising or something like that. And it didn't have a picture sleeve, no information. It's 1978. It sounded like New York to me, but eventually someone figured out that they were actually from the deep in the valley outside of Los Angeles. But I had it, and mine was the only copy known, because like we used to trade tapes and stuff with other collectors back in the early 90s, late 80s. And I made a cassette of all these mystery records I had and sent it to some of the masterminds of this stuff. And no one had heard of it. And they thought it was fake at first. Like this one guy in Chicago was a big collector dealer. He made me pretty much swear that it wasn't actually me making a fake rare punk single. Because it's happened before. And me and Tom Hazelmeyer from Amphetamine Reptile did hatch a plan to do that back in like 87. We were gonna like press up a record by a fake band called Destupt and say they were from Spokane, Washington. And we put it on our want lists, and so then other people started putting it on their want list, because that's like, well, but we never made it. We really should have. We had it all planned out. I can't remember what the song titles were. We hadn't written the songs, but that'll just take a second. we never got around to it. But this Jackie Shark single, I said, it's not me. This is as far as I know, it's real. Yeah, I found it in the dollar bin. But finally, one other copy showed up in Italy, I think. And so I ended up selling the record for $1,000. When this is like 1998, maybe. And so I was like, and I was telling my girlfriend, like, yeah, this guy's offering me $1,000 for this record. It's like, I don't know if I should do it. And she's like, do you know how many hours I have to work to make $1,000? And I kind of put it in a different light. I'm like, oh, you're right. Okay, I'll do it. But that's a record that I sold that kind of freed me up. I was like, well, because I looked around my house and I had this epiphany where I didn't see anything in my house that I wouldn't sell for $1,000. Like guitars, nothing. I didn't have any guitars that were worth more than that. So I realized that's my price, $1,000, and I could be bought.
So this is a record, and it sounds like you would just buy records that looked interesting. Like, oh, yeah. But you walk out of a place with a pile of a dozen records that you're like, oh, I don't know what it sounds like. I don't know what it's worth. Yeah. It just looks kind of interesting. You take it home, you play it, and then it would be in a box somewhere. Yep. You wouldn't know the worth of it until years later, maybe when these sort of like Discogs or other kind of sources start to come.
It took eBay to show up before you could kind of figure this out a little bit. I had this arcane knowledge of records that weren't in any price guides that I knew what they were and I knew what some of them were worth, not all of them, but I knew they were something. And the people that ran the record stores had no idea what was in there. You know, in their singles bins for the most part.
Right.
Okay. But the Jackie Shark story gets even better.
Okay.
Because he had finally got discovered, Greg Shaw from Bomp Records.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody was going through all of his demo tapes and they found a Jackie Shark and the Beach Butchers demo tape that said, had their address on it out in like maybe Ontario, California, someplace out way in the sticks. And so we know they're from California. And this other collector down in Texas, Ryan Richardson, he was really good at sleuthing out these old punks. And he, you know, went to California and managed to find Jackie Shark and got a box of singles off of Jackie Shark. And Jackie Shark started playing shows again. He looked like an old desert rat at this point.
Yeah.
He sent me a copy of the record back to me, thanking me for having him being rediscovered.
Jackie Shark did. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And someone reissued the record too. So that was great.
It all worked out.
Yeah.
So you must have quite a few records that are very precious to you. Like Jackie Shark, that's something, you know, that has come from the artist, something that's signed, something that's a memory attached to it. What are some of your precious records? And I don't mean valuable. I mean, you know, on the market, but I mean to you. If your house was on fire and you had to grab three records, what would they be?
I still have the very first record I ever bought, which was second grade at a garage sale. I bought an Elvis Presley record. I scribbled all over the cover. The record's trashed, but that's one I can't get rid of.
Yeah.
Probably the Clash self-titled LP, the American reissue from 79.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first punk record I bought. And then the first hardcore record I bought was the Adolescent self-titled album. And I still have the original copies of those. They're trashed. I also have upgrades of it. But yeah, those are pretty priceless records to me.
What's the most you've ever spent on a record?
I've never really spent that much money on a record, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was always, my thing was, I'll buy anything for a dollar. And I bought too many records for a dollar because I've given away, you know, truckloads of records back to Goodwill. I don't know what the most expensive record would be. The first record I spent a little bit of money on was Davy Allen and the Arrows, the Psychedelic album of, you know, fuzzed out biker instrumental stuff, and that was $25.
Right.
So probably some of them, and then I had to find every biker soundtrack that was ever made, and I spent about $25 or $30 on some of those as well. But that's probably about as. And now that's a cheap reissue of a record, mm-hmm. you know. So you know, times change, but yeah, I was a bargain hunter.
Now, do you still do that? Do you still, if you're driving past a yard sale or something like that, and you see a box of records, do you have to stop?
I don't really do yard sales much at all. I should do that more often. I have friends that are so much better at finding valuable records than I am at this point. I mean, it's harder and harder. This whole new generation of kids that like the vinyls has changed the whole thing. Yeah, you know, it amazes me how expensive some records that used to be so cheap are now. I'm like, really?
Yeah, what are your thoughts on that? Like, what do you think is propelling that?
Whatever the market will bear, I think. I think new records, once they got to the point where they're $25 and $30, it doesn't seem like that far of a stretch to ask that same price for a used record in good shape.
Right.
But I still, I mean... my girlfriend lives in Boise, Idaho, and there's a great record store there called the Record Exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And I go there every time I go to Boise. And they still put out records really cheap. Like last time I was there, I bought 50 albums and not one of them was more than $3. And some of it was great, like soundtracks I'd never heard of or seen before. And, you know, a lot of great stuff. But so the bargains are still out there, I think. But that said, that same store will, if they have a bad company used record, it's $30.
Yeah. So yeah, because more and more I'm starting to see, yeah, beat up copies of Led Zeppelin 4 for $40 and things like that. But, you know, you're mentioning some of those punk singles for $5,000. And I know Misfits, you know, even doubles that sometimes. They're into five figures easy, you know. I mean, crazy. What's your reaction when someone spends?
I think it's whatever people want to do. If that's, I wouldn't do it. You know, the only original Misfits single I ever had, I got it free way back in 1983 or something. It was the Glenn Danzig solo 7-inch. I can't remember what
the song was. My Darling, I think.
Nah. I can't remember if it was something about JFK. It's a good single. But I guess gave it to Hazelmyer because it was the only one he didn't have because he was such a Misfits fiend. And I guess gave it to him one day. Like, here, like, I got it free. You can have it.
Yeah.
It was like, he wanted it so badly. I was like, here, take it.
did records ever become a problem for you?
I think somewhere in the mid 90s, I was like overly obsessed. Yeah. With the Killed by Death punk stuff. And, you know, I spent a lot of time obsessing over it. I had a few friends in Seattle that we'd play records for hours and drink beer together. And that was great, great fun. But then, you know, just, yeah, I probably spent too much time searching for some of that stuff.
Okay. I mean, like space wise, did you have records in the bathtub? Did it
kind of
get out of control?
No. I was pretty organized. I had a whole room that was lined with shelves that had all the records.
Okay.
Once I moved to Portland, then it was kind of silly because I had a storage unit full of records because they wouldn't all fit in my house. So that was silly. I paid rent on storing my records for years.
Were they organized to the point to where if you wanted to find a record, you could do that rather easily?
They were. But I had to move a couple more times. And when I was DJing more, my singles boxes got less and less organized. And actually, 2 weeks ago, I re-alphabetized all my modern singles, which here, these are all the boxes of them over there.
Wow. Those do look organized.
Yeah. And then I have another 10 boxes of 60s and 50s singles and whatnot. But I actually spent many an hour re-alphabetizing them all and realized that I had doubles of a lot of singles I didn't realize I have doubles of.
You know, and maybe this is a record collector thing, but I love just spending time with my collection, re-alphabetizing. If I had to re-alphabetize my records, that's a great weekend to me. You know, do you enjoy that sort of organization?
Well, it reminded me what I have. It also bittersweetly reminded me of what I don't have anymore. As I was going through, I was like, oh man, I sold that. Dang it. Like mental note, like, yeah, I should have been writing down a list of records to find the reissues of, you know, as I was going through them.
Is there a holy grail that you're looking for? Something you'd love to find?
I don't know. It seems like, I mean, I really like the reissues of obscure things I've never heard of. So I find holy grails that I didn't even know existed because they're still like pulling things out of the mist and reissuing them. You know, I always get excited just finding a whole nother little path to explore. Obviously, we were hugely influenced by a lot of Australian music.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple years ago, discovering the Colored Balls was pretty great.
Oh, okay. Bobby Lloyd.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Lobby Lloyd. Because I knew some of that stuff, but I didn't have the actual Colored Balls records. Oh, I know one for Australia. The Angels' first 7-inch, Am I Ever Gonna See Your Face Again?
Fuck you. Da, 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 da. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, but I have the live version of it, but the very first single 7-inch only version of it.
All right.
That'd be high on my list.
Excellent. Our sleuths will get to work.
And hey, if you find any You're So Boring by The Rocks or anything like that, you know, like, bring it on. Original copies of the Victim 7-inches from
Earth would be cool. Now you're getting greedy.
I know. Well, Guy is from Perth.
Yeah.
Yeah, he lives down in Melbourne now. But he had all that stuff, you know, and he doesn't even know what happened to it all. I'm like, dude, what happened to your box of Australian singles? He's like, oh, I think a friend had them, or, you know, I'm like, ah.
Exactly. Yeah. When you're down there, let's hunt them down. Let's find them. Because, yeah. 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 Well, they have reissues of Victims.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, got that. And I don't know if you know, Victims, they did some, they did a reissue not long ago with Ray On of Hard-Ons.
Yeah, they played some shows, didn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would have loved to have seen that.
When it comes to vinyl, and I guess, you know, you've been a collector for years and years and years throughout the history of the band. Were you the guy that all the test pressings came to? Were you the deep listener that reviewed those?
Well, we all got test pressings of everything.
Mm-hmm.
I sold all the test pressings a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
I had a whole box of early Sub Pop test pressings, including Nirvana 7-inch test pressing. It lives down in Australia somewhere. I sold it to an Australian.
Oh, dear Lord.
Yeah. But now we all had the test pressings, and, you know, but I decided at one point, I don't care about the test pressings. So I started selling all the old Sub Pop ones. It's kind of fun on Discogs. Some of the pictures of test pressings are mine because I recognize my writing on the label and stuff. I'm like, ah, that's cool. You know, he survived. They're out there, you know.
Now, from what I understand, the Mudhoney single, Touch Me, I'm Sick, on Sub Pop, you had given the idea to Bruce about the Sub Pop Singles Club. But Touch Me, I'm Sick wasn't part of that club. It was just before that club started. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I know Bruce credits me with that, but it's a little bit more murky than that. I remember going out to eat with Jonathan and Bruce for lunch, because when Mudhoney first started, I dropped out of college and I was living at home with my parents and I didn't have a job. So I'd just go down and help the early days of Sub Pop. I'd box stuff up, but they weren't paying me, but they'd always buy me lunch, you know. Mm-hmm. And we were at lunch at a Mexican restaurant and talking about singles. And, you know, AmRep had just kind of started doing some really limited Halo of Flies singles. And Tom had just moved back to Minneapolis and was kind of getting his label up and running for real. Like, he was done with his military service. And, you know, I was just talking about how I love these bands that are putting out these super limited singles, and it kind of hypes them up pretty well. Mm-hmm. There's things, Drunks with Guns, Anti-Scene. There's a weird underground of American post-hardcore scuzzy bands that were doing limited run singles. And I was like, this is a great deal. And then they kind of, as we were talking, they were like, we could get the money up front, and that would help pay for getting the records pressed. And that's kind of where the idea for the Singles Club came. It was kind of genius because they had a cash flow problem at this point, but getting people's money
in advance.
In advance, yeah. That was the genius there, you know. And obviously there was lots of bands that we were all friends with that were happy to do some kind of on Sub Pop, and it got hyped up so quickly. It just kind of kept feeding on itself until it got kind of too big, and, you know, a 4,000 run single of some, you know, not great band, you know, those you can still find those are still dollar records. You know, it got too big. The appeal was gone for a while. They bring it back every now and again. Every few years they do it again.
I think they're doing it now. Yeah, but
there's a new slew of them coming out. Yeah.
So the Touch Me, I'm Sick, that single, there were about 1,000, I think, if I recall, 800 brown, 200 black.
Yeah. And those were the promo ones, I guess.
Right.
Technically.
Okay. So the black ones, so everyone got the brown ones, or that was the majority of them that were brown, but there were special colors and only about a dozen or so each of those.
Yeah. I don't know the real actual numbers of all those random colors, but basically the pressing plant did that as kind of an apology and goodwill gesture because they were behind schedule on getting it to Sub Pop. And so, you know, they, even at Cascade when I was working there, you could get a deal where they just use whatever's colors are left over and you can get records pressed cheaper that way because there's not enough for a full run of a particular color. So the geniuses at the presses just kind of mix and match. And that's what they did. So there were some really cool colors. There was bright purple. There was red. There was yellow fading almost into brown. Like, because the brown ones, some of them are kind of yellowish, mm-hmm. you know. My favorite, I think, was clear. But it was kind of murky clear. It was like kind of dirty dishwater clear.
Right.
I think that was my favorite one that I had. I sold all those, though. Yeah. I have one brown one left at this point. And a black one, I think. Yeah. Which it was always like so frustrating that the black ones were worth a fraction of what the brown ones were. I was like, but it's more rare. There's right. only 200 black ones.
Now, out of those special, out of those colors, are those the rarest Mudhoney records?
Probably, yeah.
Okay.
I don't know what else would be. I mean, test pressings are rare. Sub Pop in the old days, at first, you automatically got 5 test pressings. Mm-hmm. From the pressing plant, and they upped that to 10. Then I know they upped it significantly after that. But the first couple years of Sub Pop records, I would say test pressings are like 10 copies.
Did you ever reject, listen to a test pressing and reject it?
Yeah. Yeah, we have. I think only a couple times, but it's definitely happened. Recently, I'm trying to think of what record it was recently that. Well, the Mudhoney Meat Puppets 7-inch we did a couple years ago was problematic. It was supposed to be done before pandemic, and we were going to go on tour with Meat Puppets, and we were trying to get it pressed up at Cascade. But that's when I was still working there, and their 7-inch machine wasn't quite up to speed yet. Mm. So we rejected those, and then Sub Pop sent the record to be pressed at Third Man. And I think there might have been another problem at Third Man with it, too. Where like something was just chopped off slightly, but maybe I could be wrong there, but there's something in the last few years that we had to send back to get redone. I mean, there's so many different variables that where the problem could be coming from, you know.
Now those rejected test pressings, I would imagine that those become extraordinarily collectible because no other copies are made, even if they are subpar.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I remember in the early Sub Pop years, I think Right Between the Eyes, the 7-inch by Love Battery was rejected. I think the rarest Nirvana thing from Sub Pop, which I wish I'd kept, was a whole batch of Bleach cassettes were made missing a song.
Oh, really? Okay.
I think one of the songs was cut out of the master tape to make a 7-inch or something like that. And so the whole cassette is missing a song. So there's hundreds, like boxes and boxes of these Bleach tapes that were missing a song. I've never looked that up on Discogs to see if that's mentioned, but I'm sure it is. I mean, there's obsessives out there.
Let's take a look at it. I seem to recall back in the day, my copy of Bleach was missing Love Buzz.
On cassette?
No, it was actually a CD. I remember when I got a reissue of it, and I was like, oh, whoa, there's a whole new song here that I didn't realize was on there. Bleach CD cassette. Oh boy.
It's probably 4,000 of them.
The 113 cassettes. Yeah. while we do that, do you collect international versions like the Agogos or the Waterfront?
For Mudhoney stuff, I've got all that. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Agogo is one of my favorite labels, you know, first off. So it was so rad to be on Agogo Records. And Waterfront was great too. I mean, there was just so much good Australian music that we loved that was coming out in the 80s.
I know. I moved here in 2001 and I'm still catching up on on things.
Well, there's always great music coming out of Australia.
Yeah, I can't find it right now. Okay, we'll look a bit later on it. Okay, so starting Super Electro Records. Now you kind of start this label and you come into it with a bit of a collector mindset. I wouldn't even say a bit of it, with a serious collector mindset, limited runs and things like that. What was your thought in embarking on that?
Well, it was 1992, and there was three bands or three recordings that I was somewhat involved in. I was in the Fallouts. I was playing bass in the Fallouts at the time, and we had a record recorded. And then Ed Fotheringham and Joe Culver and myself, we were roommates, basically. We did a record called The Sad and Lonelies. And then I had the Night Kings that were friends of mine and like just a great, really gnarly garage punk band from Seattle. And so there was these three records that needed to come out somewhere. And I was bugging Bruce about it at Sub Pop. And I think he was getting tired of me bugging him about it. So he said, look, why don't you just start a record label and put them out yourself? And then he said, and we'll get them pressed up through our deal with Erica. And so you don't have to foot the bill at first. So those first three records came out with a Super Electro logo and a Sub Pop logo on them. And they were also licensed over to Germany for Glitterhouse Records. Mm-hmm. So that kind of got me going on it. And then I started putting out a bunch of singles, you know, fairly quickly after that. The Statics, Well Water Conspiracy. And that I footed the bill on that. And then my girlfriend Karen helped me, you know, run the thing. It was, you know, it was a, I wasn't that serious about it. I should have taken it more seriously, maybe, but I was busy collecting records.
Well, it would seem, look, you know, I always saw that label and, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, look, there were a lot of wild things that were happening in the 90s. And, you know, you could be forgiven for being ambitious about something because you're seeing all these acts and music take off and all these things that you didn't expect to happen. Why not make a label? Why not fashion, you know, get some of the other labels that that inspired you? So,
yeah. And I had a lot of friends that were in bands I liked. So, I mean, some, you know, that whole garage, the 90s garage rock revival, Estrus Records and stuff. I loved it, but a lot of those bands didn't need my help. You know, they're okay. They've got like eight labels putting out singles by them this month, which is awesome, but they didn't need my help. Like the Makers, I loved them. They were friends of mine and they were from Spokane originally, but they didn't need my help. You know, they had so many records coming out already. And same with, you know, Mono Men and stuff that, but there was kind of underdog bands that didn't quite fit in, like the Kent 3 that I really tried to champion, and they just didn't quite fit in. And so never quite got off the ground with them. But the Fallouts did pretty well. And Warner Brothers let me put out the vinyl for Mudhoney's Tomorrow Hit Today. And that was a funny thing in itself, because there was so much. That was near the end of us with Warner Brothers, and nobody cared about us. And the people in charge of the projects kept changing. So I literally never talked to anybody at Warner Brothers about putting that record out. Oh. Somebody had said I could do it. There was never anything in writing, nothing. I just, I got the tape of it, you know, the DAT at the time, I'm sure, you know, got it mastered and got it pressed up. And nobody from Warner Brothers ever said a word to me about it.
Because Hazelmeyer was saying at Atlantic, and you probably had this conversation with him before, but at Atlantic, when Melvins were signed, they actually printed up Melvins, Houdini, and Stag and whatnot on vinyl, gave those copies to Tom to sell. So he actually got the free product printed from them. But what you're saying is you didn't get any permission. You just kind of did it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
It was funny because this was 1998. I sold 4,000 copies on vinyl, which is a lot for back then. And they said they didn't even sell 10,000 copies on CD. I was like, I could have done that in my sleep. You know, like it was like I said, it was the end of us with Warner Brothers, and they had given up on us and we'd given up on them.
Now, aside from Mudhoney, what was the top seller on Super Electro?
Fallout Sleep.
Okay.
Fallout Sleep sold pretty well, actually. You know, I did it on a CD as well. Mm-hmm. For a band of the Fallout's stature, which was fairly limited, they never really toured or anything. They sold over 4,000 or 5,000 CDs and at least 2,000 on vinyl.
I think, didn't Super Electro release Into Your Shtick, a single on that?
Yeah, I did two Mudhoney 7-inchers.
Yeah. Okay. Was that with the label's blessing or was that also subterfuge?
Yeah, they didn't care.
Okay.
You know, I don't even know if I even said with permission from Warner Brothers on the sleeves of those singles or not. They didn't. Warner Brothers was pretty cool. They didn't care if we had side projects. We didn't want a lot of money in advance because we didn't want to be indebted to them. I think we played it pretty as well as we could have. We got out fairly unscathed from our major label deal.
And you're still friendly with them, you know, as evidenced by this box set that's coming out.
Yeah. They're you know, they were, well, you know, at the time Reprise was still kind of the artist boutique label there. And they'd had some people that still worked there from the 60s. So they understood artists that might not sell a whole lot of records, but you build a career with them. You know, I mean, they had a lot of artists like that on Reprise. and then by the time we left Warner Brothers, all those people were long gone.
Right.
But okay. Because the industry changed so quickly in the 90s, you know.
Now, Night of the Hunted, the single, has this little bullet hole poke through on the record. And a blood stain on the back of the sleeve. Tell me about that. Did you actually have to go to a manufacturer to poke those holes?
No, I did the poking myself and the stamping. I made a rubber stamp of the blood. I stole that idea from an old Cleveland fanzine called Clee, C-L-E. And it was this old punk and kind of art rock fanzine from the 70s. And one of the covers of their magazine had a very similar thing. I was like, that's cool. I'm going to do that. So I guess I had a drill. I mean, I put those singles all together. Me and my girlfriend would just do that in the evenings, you know.
Is it a hand drill? Just...
Yeah. I just had a hand drill and drilled through all the sleeves. I was designing all those sleeves too at the time. It was like kind of a little fun thing I was doing. Sometimes for technical help, I'd go over to Art Chantry's office or Ed Fotheringham's office and get some help from them. Art always just thought my ideas were terrible, which is awesome. Because he's such a curmudgeon anyway. It's like he had no praise for my artistic abilities when it came to graphic design and layout. But he helped me on, but he also helped me on some of the other covers for Super Electro as well.
Yeah. Now I saw that right before the pandemic hit, there was a Melvin's Mudhoney session, White Lazy Boy, the EP that came out. I understand there may be more of those recordings or perhaps some more coming out in the future. What's the status of that?
Well, I hope so. I mean, that was literally the last thing Mark and I did musically. We got home on March 5th, I think, of that year. Mm-hmm. So just a few days before everything went to hell. Our plan was we were going to get together with the Melvins in August, that coming August of 2020, to do some more. Mm-hmm. It went so well and it's so fun. And, you know, we were going to get Dan and Guy involved too and, you know, just see what we all came up with. And I still want to do that. But, you know, they got super busy again. I mean, the Melvins are always busy.
They're always busy, I mean, right?
Such a hard worker.
Never sit still.
I hope we can do more because it was really fun and it was only a few days. And I think we just kind of started scratching the surface of what we could come up with all of us together, you know, because I mean, they're very relaxed. They have no preconceived notions and that's good to remind myself of too. Like, okay, Melvin's, they'll do anything. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a great frame of mind to have.
They're always moving forward and they're trying and experimenting.
Incredibly challenging music sometimes. And they just expect their fans to come along or not. Like, they just do exactly what they want.
Yeah. Melvin's remind me a bit like they've taken a page out of the Frank Zappa book. You know, they do what they want and they have a base of fans that will follow them. And, but at the end of the day, there are some phases of their career, which you're more attracted to than others. And that's okay.
And I like that they still play some of the old songs. They still play some of the songs occasionally from their very first 7-inch. Mm-hmm. And cause you know, I mean, I saw them when they were still a hardcore band. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They finally issued some of that stuff, Melvin's 83 or Melvin's 84, and played some of it live, but they were, we first saw them in 1984, they were like the tightest, fastest hardcore band in Seattle or playing in Seattle, mm-hmm. which is so weird that they changed so drastically fairly quickly.
And I seem to have read, and maybe it was even in your book, that Melvin's, the song Leech from Gluey Porch Treatments, that was a riff which you had written originally. Is that right?
That was an early Green River song. Yeah.
Okay.
They still play that too, which is pretty funny. At this point, when they put it out on a record, it just says written by the Melvins. It's like, fair enough.
Did it ever say Turner or
anything? I don't know. I don't even know if Hazelmeyer knew that it was a Green River song originally. But it's they made it their own. It's their song.
Yeah.
It would be kind of fun to cover it with them, though. I always thought that could be kind of a fun thing to do with the Melvins, with Mark singing.
There you go. There's one of the songs for the next session.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, Steve, it's very clear you are one of us. You are a record nerd of the highest order, and really excited to see you guys coming back to Australia. I'm going to put links in this episode page where people can get tickets. Of course, if you need any directions to any record shops, please let us know. Of course, Guy, I'm sure has quite a compass for finding those as well.
Yeah, I think he figured out a good one down in Melbourne already.
Oh yeah. There's a couple there, and there's a couple here. So I'm happy to send you my notes as well for Sydney. And I want to make sure everyone knows about the new Mud Honey LP coming out April 7th on Sub Pop. There's a limited loser vinyl copy which people can get mudhoney.bandcamp.com. There's how many of those are pressed up? Is that a 500 on those?
I don't know. I think they're generally about 500 for the loser editions.
Right. Okay. Cool. All right. So people can get those at mudhoney.bandcamp.com or at subpop.com. You could also see Mud Honey on tour. It sounds like they will have vinyl at the merch booth as well as a limited release 7-inch that is an Aussie only for the Aussie only tour. Yeah.
Yep.
Excellent. So all those links will be in the episode page. And Steve, thank you so much for coming on the show. And we hope to have you back soon, man.
Sure thing. I'll be happy to be back.
All right, Steve, thanks for coming on the show. Can't wait to catch you guys down under. Again, the album Plastic Eternity, April 7th. Dial it up on your streaming services now. Check out some tunes and get ready for the full album available April 7th. Vinyl runs are available at mudhoney.org, along with details and tickets for their upcoming tour of Australia, which includes that special Tim Records limited edition 7-inch vinyl single. Catch Mud Honey live, and I'll see you at the merch table. And that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes on your social media. Put them on Facebook, tweet them out on Twitter, share them to different Facebook groups or Reddit threads. That is always appreciated, as are positive reviews up on Apple iTunes or Spotify or Apple Podcasts, whatever they call it these days. Give us 5 out of 5 or 10 out of 10 stars. Say something nice. Make us blush. That is always appreciated. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.